Okay, let's go ahead and get started for our and continue our discussion from this morning. Let's now discuss the election to adopt U.S. GAAP or IFRS that's under consideration. Although the FASB and the International Accounting Standards Board are working towards convergence, differences still remain between their standards. The SEC noted these differences in the two SEC releases that we previously mentioned this morning. Different protocols exist for determining an appropriate answer when U.S. GAAP and IFRS standards do not cover a particular matter. This leads us to our next question, our question number four, which is, are there specific differences between U.S. GAAP and IFRS that are so significant that they pose unique challenges for U.S. auditors? Do any provisions of the International Financial Reporting Standards pose auditability concerns? Any comments? Cynthia Richardson?
As we talked about earlier, there are material differences between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. And I think the laundry list contained in the briefing paper is quite good as sort of an example that in some instances, IFRS doesn't even have comprehensive standards or any standards at all, as opposed to the comprehensive guidance on the U.S. GAAP side. So I think that would make auditing particularly difficult in those circumstances. Limited guidance on the extractive industries. And this one I found particularly troublesome, that there's no common format for the income statement, which I think is only going to add to investor confusion. No standards on mergers, recapitalizations, et cetera. So I think it poses a significant risk and a significant challenge for investors understanding the financial statements if this happens.
Joe Carcel.
Cindy beat me to the punch, but that was really exactly what I wanted to say, but I'm going to elaborate a little bit on it. One of the things that you don't have in the briefing paper is you really talk about differences in the guidance from international standards to U.S. standards, in my view, largely talking about level A GAAP. But what about level B, level C, and level D GAAP? That's a very significant body of literature. And if you look at level B GAAP, we're talking about extractive industries, Cindy, and insurance. There are industry accounting and auditing guides on airlines, on casinos, on broker-dealers, on and on and on and on and on. What happens to that? That goes away. What about ESOPs? ESOPs are a very significant form of financing. There's an SOP on ESOPs. That's the only guidance that I'm aware of on ESOPs. There's no analog to that in the international standards. So if a U.S. registrant adopted IFRS, because the SEC allowed that, how would the auditor handle, what would they rely on? I would assume they'd go back to U.S. GAAP because that's all that's there. But the company could argue, well, we don't have to follow that. The SEC's given us the option of using IFRS.
Bob Kippers.
You know, those points that Cindy and Joe made are they're valid, but I think that there's a much bigger issue. In terms of unique challenges for U.S. auditors, and I'll just take the conventional characterization that we have more of a rules-based set of standards and that IFRS is certainly closer to principles-based, although you could take some issue that it's truly achieved that. And it's the cultural difference of how you go about working with your client, how you go about being challenged by the regulators, the possibility of very similar facts coming up with two different answers and both being right. We have an entire certainly one generation, maybe a little more, of people who were trained and their skills were based on essentially a lot of the rules and a lot of the levels of guidance we have today. If we're really going to transition, and just take it all the way, transition to a U.S. system where principles-based standards rule the creation of financial statements, that's a big, big change in terms of how we work with our client as an auditor, because it's going to be much more judgment-oriented and as awkward as it is today when clients say, you know, tell me where it says I can't do that, we're going to be in a much less definitive space when we say, well, I just disagree with you. My judgment versus yours. And if you disagree to the point where you're not willing to sign the opinion, then you've got a bit of a standoff. I just think that, you know, I think there's general support for more principles-based, but I also think that, you know, many are ill-prepared to live in that world. Not that it's bad, it's just different. But I think if, as an auditor, that's going to significantly change the way you interface work the best you can with your client.
Bob Tarola.
On this question, it's hard for me to envision the what I would call the auditing issues around verifying a number under whatever regime the client is using. I think auditors are very skilled at verification and assessment. The question comes to sort of the fairly present question and the true and fair view question of the financial statements when completed. And I want to just point out a current dilemma in that area. Management's certifications of financial statements go to fair presentation, period, not in conformity with U.S. GAAP. Just period. Whereas auditors' opinions go to U.S. GAAP. There's already this dichotomy between the SEC's requirements of management and the profession's requirements of auditors. And I think that the more different reporting standards that exist, the harder that's going to be to reconcile between fairly stated period and fairly stated in conformity with what.
Any other comments on question four? If not, then Brian DeGano is going to lead us through the our discussion of the next series of topics.
Thanks, Greg. And our next topic is evaluation of the fair presentation of the financial statements. And in performing an audit in accordance with PCAOB standards, auditors consider whether the financial statements present fairly in all material respects of the financial position, results of operations, and cash flows of a company. PCAOB interim standards, specifically AU section 411.04, provide guidance for auditors. The next question for the SAG to consider is the guidance contained in AU section 411.04 sufficient for audits of financial statements in accordance with IFRS? And as a follow-on question, what other amendments or additions to PCAOB standards might the board need to consider if issuers were allowed to prepare IFRS financial statements? And I'll open it up to the SAG for discussion. Ben Coleman.
I mean, I think that I think our view is that it is a principles-based. It's fine. It certainly is going to need to be amended should the commission ultimately accept. So when you're defining GAAP, you're going to have to amend it, obviously, with respect to beyond U.S. GAAP. But that the principles are sufficient.
Let me just add a little bit. You could probably look at this question in different ways. It perhaps is a more general question and maybe not just really limited to IFRS, and perhaps more broadly could be applied against what one might call a more principles-based accounting framework. It seems to me that there may be more pressure put on both management, as Bob Tarola mentioned, and auditors in evaluating fair presentation in a more principles-based framework. So I guess I'd ask the question, is that true? Do you agree with that? And secondly, if that is the case, is there is it appropriate, or is there a way for auditing standards to help auditors any more than we already do in that particular challenge?
Oh, Galen Hansen.
I promise not to get off point. With that said, go Rockies, you know. So, but
that was out of order.
All right, it was out of order. 411. You know, it seems to me that's addressing the audit report, but operationally, implementation-wise, it seems to me that there's also some ancillary issues that could affect the audit report in the area of loan compliance. When you're dealing with one set of standards that people contemplated years ago when they entered into loan agreements, and then down the road, you've got a new standard, and which one really controls and governs when it comes to whether or not you're in compliance with those standards, and that does have an effect on the audit report.
Ben Coleman.
You know, I also serve on FASAC, and this discussion, Tom, what you just raised, was discussed with Bob up at FASAC in a very similar kind of way. Because the notion of going to principles-based is going to change the behavior and the culture, what Bob Kippers was just saying. It's a reality, and I think it's a reality we're ultimately going to have to deal with. It's just a matter of when. And I liken it, just for simplicity, to goalposts, right? That, you know, there's this whole discussion about equivalency, things like that. You know, that there are places, whether you go to the right or to the left, where things are both acceptable and preferable given a set of facts and circumstances and the complexity of the world, and you need to be true to those principles. And there needs to be understandability, and there needs to be transparency. Then there's places where you're outside the goalposts. You know, you're just simply too far to the right or too far to the left. And we're going to need to begin to accept and how to help both preparers and auditors understand where those goalposts are and make sure that we're serving investors the way they expect to be served, because it's the reality of where we're going to be.
Jeff Steinhoff.
What you're really talking about is a fairly substantive change. Decades of working under the current regime and people learning by trial and error, by good and bad experiences, and a certain expectation of what represents a quality job and what these terms mean. You're now moving into a different set of waters, so to speak, somewhat uncharted. And I'm not sure whether it's that this guidance isn't sufficient or whether there just needs to be a new set of guidance and tools. You have a major training and educational process here. A lot of these things are difficult to understand under the current environment. And you're going to a different new environment where people do not have the same base of knowledge that's been built up over decades and decades. So to the extent there can be new and additional guidance, tools, things the colleges can use, this may well affect, maybe this is another part of the meeting, but who can be involved with this? Does this make it even harder for a smaller firm to actually, you know, operate in this environment? But you've got a tremendous amount of unknown here. It's very difficult, I think, to look at a certain section and say, is that sufficient? My guess is it probably isn't, or it probably needs to be changed in some way, or there probably needs to be some other guidance. So you have some degree of predictability, and then at the end of the day, when you're inspecting someone, you know what you're inspecting them against, because you're expecting a certain level today. And you're expecting to see things a certain way within, you know, the left and the right, so to speak. You don't have to be right down the center of the goalpost every time. But here you really haven't, you know, we don't have the experience. So my guess would be you'd have to make changes in some of the guidance.
Bob Kippers.
Just a follow-up. I think that one of the challenges, and I just listening to Jeff, who may be right, and wouldn't be the first time, but, you know, some of this is so intangible, though I'm not sure that you can create a standard that we're or need to even change the one we have to really affect it, because it's such a change in skills and culture, and, you know, the people who have lots of experience around this table probably aren't, I know I'm not worried about that world. I could function in it, no problem, but it's how we train and season our young people as they come up. And I know there's questions about education and things that are next, but I really think it's not fundamentally a standards issue so much as a shift and a change in how we behave and how we face off against the market.
Joe Carcella.
I'm going to follow up on Vin's point, and you talked about the goalposts. And I guess the concern, Vin, that I think some people would have is, are the goalposts wider on IFRS than they are on the U.S. GAAP? That's really the question. Do we have wider goalposts? And, you know, one of the things, I don't think this is necessarily a PCAOB issue, but, you know, is there more evidence of earnings management when IFRS are used than U.S. GAAP? Is it more likely that analyst forecasts are met or beaten when IFRS are used in U.S. GAAP? Zovana's favorite topic, abnormal accruals. Is there more evidence of earnings management or whatever metric you want to use under IFRS than under U.S. GAAP? And that may get at the width of the goalpost, which I think is a concern to certainly investors.
Tom Linsmeyer.
This isn't an auditing standards issue, but I think we need to think about this in context of the financial reporting system with the United States. We have, in the United States, the ability to have, even before there's any failure of a company or litigation, three different parties looking at the financial statements and questioning the financial statements of a preparer. The auditor has that job. But then the Division of Corporation Finance of the SEC weighs in. And third, the inspections teams of the PCAOB weigh in. What is going to happen when there's lots of judgment or more judgment within the system? How are we going to behave? Can we change and respect that judgment? And more importantly, what happens when I'm talking about maybe well-intended judgment at this point, that ex post you find out the judgment was not well-intended. What happens to your abilities when you look back in hindsight about the judgments that are permitted and whether they're credible within the system? And if you have both U.S. GAAP and IFRS GAAP, IFRS system, will we get into litigation where you're comparing what the reported net income or numbers were under one method or another to further question the system that's under use problematically? Right now, with 20 Fs, there are great variations in net income. Jack Sizelski, the Accounting Observer, has done a very good job sort of summarizing that. Right now, in terms of IFRS, sometimes U.S. GAAP gives you larger net income, but most of the times it's IFRS giving you larger net income. And the numbers are around 25% in terms of mean and median. That's not an insignificant difference. But as we're looking at this as we go forward, I think it's not an auditing standard issue, but how are we as a system going to deal with the second guessing ex ante and then second guessing ex post, and what is it going to do in litigation?
Arnie Hamish.
I guess where I come from on this is wherever these goalposts. I mean, first of all, this, I'm not sure that the statement AU 41104 needs to be modified, but I think the goalposts, as Vin refers to them, really will be defined by the company, at least in my view, and it'll be documented. You'll have principle. We have principles today that we have to deal with, and we document them. We disclose them. To me, the key is the consistent application of those principles. And what you don't want are companies looking at those goalposts and modifying their principles within the goalposts. And I think that's the key. And from an auditing standpoint, what you want to be able to do is make sure that whatever definition of principle, or however you define the principle, that it is consistently applied year in and year out, to the same kinds of transactions and activities. So there isn't that opportunity. And I think that, to me, that's the key. It's making sure the companies have it documented well enough and disclosed, and that the auditors validate the fact that we're consistently applying these principles. And then you shouldn't have the concerns and the worries.
David Becker.
I actually think there is an auditing concern embedded in this. Whatever the difference between principles and rules means, and I'm frankly not sure that it has a great deal of meaning, it suggests at least that the controlling rules are going to be more general, or are more general than they are now. And to use the goalpost analogy again, we've got three problems. Are the goalposts narrower? Do they move? And are they visible? And without a principle of deference, an attempt to rely more on people's judgment is going to fail. The question is, whose judgment is conclusive and whose judgment is being expressed? So without the confidence, for example, that within some range that their judgment as to accounting issues will be conclusive, issuers and auditors are going to press for more guidance, or they're going to take principle-based guidance as if it were a rules-based. And we've all had experience with that. So that when you talk about fair presentation, you can't really uncouple that from questions of whose view and whose view is conclusive.
Ted White.
Thank you. I just want to step back a little bit. I thought Joe's comments right before we went to lunch were just outstanding, and I would really struggle to add to that. I thought it was just an excellent summary of some of the issues here. And there, you know, from an investor standpoint, there's a number of reasons why I don't like what's coming. But frankly, I'm not sure what that has to do with you, except you have to deal with it. So I guess to move it to action, what are the things that, from an investor standpoint, we would want you to consider doing in preparation? And I suppose that maybe getting the jump on guidance, whether something's going to happen now or whether it's going to be much longer down the road, still going to happen. And that maybe getting a start on, you know, some fairly specific guidance, and it sounds like there's an awful lot of work to do there. But also, how should this affect risk assessment? And it seems to me like, I mean, that's a very integral thing that we talk about at most SAG meetings, that we have a lot of work to do in the coming years on it, and this probably impacts that. But maybe also the inspection process, and so maybe there's a three-prong approach to what, you know, what do you have to do with this? And the last just comment is I'm sort of struck by the link between what we're talking about now and our first topic of the day, which was, you know, your resources and the list of items we need to deal with. It just seems to be a very good example here of what happens to the PCAOB is from externalities that you can't control are probably going to have a fairly significant impact on your ability to be successful with that list. And I don't know what to do about it, obviously, but it seems, you know, some flexibility in your willingness and ability to deal with these things has to be built into your budget.
David Julian.
As chief accounting officer, I heard a lot from our lines of business questioning whether I was holding our lines of business to a stricter standard than their peers out in other organizations. whether our accounting firm was holding us to stricter interpretation, and that all in a relatively rules-based environment. Moving to a judgment-based, my fear is that the pressure or the concern is how will we ensure the firms have consistency not only within their own firm, but also across firms, because, again, as a practitioner, when we're sitting there with the lines of business trying to interpret certain decisions and the flexibility they have in applying the accounting rules, they're looking at what are their peers being held to and what are other lines of business being held to. And so it's going to continue to be a challenge moving into a judgment-based environment and a concern. And my concern is that because of that, firms will start creating their own rules as to how to apply judgment. And pretty soon you're moving into a rules-based environment, but the rules didn't have the opportunity of an open forum to be created. And so certainly concerned there.
Dick Dietrich.
Again, I feel just a little bit like a foreigner, although I understand they play football at Ohio State. So I'm thinking I ought to get this goalpost idea down a little bit better and make sure that I understand what we're really talking about. And I think one way that I look at it is, are there differences in the widths, and how can that be changed if we start looking at IFRS? If there are differences in the width of the goalpost under IFRS, if more things would be deemed acceptable under the accounting principles generally, what's the auditor's responsibility? Is the auditor's responsibility, when we look at this and say, presents fairly, that is, we'll take a wider goalpost, and if it's a wider goalpost, therefore we can give an opinion that it presents fairly as long as it's anywhere inside the goalposts, regardless of what we personally think as the auditors? Or if we've been watching, for example, using this analogy again, that the kicker consistently puts the ball on the right-hand side of the just in the right-hand goalpost, and the ball's consistently going there, quarter after quarter, and then we see the ball way over on the left side, still inside the goalpost. What does the auditor do then? Does the auditor say, "Wait a minute, it's not consistently applied," or it is consistently applied because it's in the goalpost? And so you go ask management, you say, or the kicker, "Why is the ball over on the left this time?" And he says, "I thought there was going to be a wind that was going to drive it over, so I pushed the ball, and that's the way it ends up." Where do you get the judgment guidance on how to make this determination as the auditor? Now, on one hand, the words that I see here are the words that we worked with for a long time. We seem to be able to work within those words. But I see instances in which we do question the words now. I'm not sure whether more guidance will help us, but I am sure that in a world where we're looking at potentially different widths of goalposts, that these issues will arise. And if we're not prepared for them, they'll arise in ways that I think all of us will feel uncomfortable later.
Damon Silvers.
I want to make a more general comment about the range of issues raised by the possibility of IFRS filers in our markets. I am less, some of whom as a surprise to some, I'm less sort of opposed in principle to the idea that there would be a single global accounting regime, and some may be. It strikes me that we increasingly have single, sort of unified markets in many respects, since we have those, having unified financial reporting arrangements probably is a good idea and probably is in investors' interest. However, I'm concerned in listening to this discussion, and the AFL-CIO does not have an opinion on the question of the SEC's proposed rule at this time, and I've been trying to learn about it and what its implications might be. Struck by several things here. One is the relative lack of, I think the documents the staff prepared are very helpful, but the relative lack of understanding of market participants in the United States of what these differences are and what the potential entrant into our markets of IFRS filers would mean the reluctance of the U.S.-based corporate community to engage in a move away from GAAP generally that I perceive. I may be wrong about that. The feeling that I have in listening to these discussions that that for good reasons, I don't fault the commission in this respect, that we may be moving in this direction prematurely, that convergence is probably a better idea than choice, and that we need to have a strategy in relationship to our regulators for how to get the right kind of convergence, and that choice may take away our leverage in that process. These are very tentative conclusions I'm coming to, and we have an open mind. I personally and my employer institutionally have an open mind about this. But I think that just in listening to this discussion, that it feels like in many different ways we're just not quite ready for this. And the thing I'm most struck by is that we have these very substantial areas of great discretion that the staff outlined here, which then the question comes, okay, either in the minds of the PCAOB or ultimately in the minds of the courts, you know, what constitutes a fair presentation of financial statements in this context? And if no one knows the answer, is it necessarily good for us in terms of the way we want to treat foreign private issuers to expose them to that? So I sound a note of caution. I'm willing to be persuaded that I shouldn't worry, but I'm a little concerned now.
Lynn Turner.
I don't think it matters what title you put on the accounting standards, where you put IASB at the top or FASB at the top. What matters is whether whatever you end up with, it gives investors the information they need in a very timely and complete fashion to be able to make an informed decision so the markets do stay efficient. So I think that's where you have to start with the guiding light. When you think back about the problems that we've had in the markets right up to the current time period, even as we all sit here with the subprime mess, I step back and I say, clearly we've had some problems with U.S. standards and with some of the debacles that we have there. If I was someone resident in London, I'd probably be saying, why would I put my money in the U.S. markets? Because the standards over there really haven't given me protection. In fact, we saw record amounts of cash outflows out of the U.S. markets by foreign investors in August. And it's not the first time it's happened. It happened with the Enrons and all. So realistically, I understand why people overseas come in and say the risk in the U.S. capital markets is appears to be quite significant anymore to investors. Every time they turn around, they're losing money over here, watching television as their depositors take a run on North Rock. And so you have to ask, are our standards really good or that good? Likewise, though, the international standards have certainly fallen short. And you look at the protections in places like Japan, which I mentioned earlier, where they actually had to shut down a firm because the audits were so bad and fraud was involved within the audit firm. So to me, neither one has demonstrated their ability to get investors, quite frankly, what they need. So I've been of the opinion for quite some period of time that you keep the reconciliation in place because it's the hammer you use and the oversight tool you use, the carrot, if you will, to force the FASB and force the ISB to keep improving the standards to get them to where they need to be. And neither one's perfect, and both have a long ways to go, but if you lose that hook with the reconciliation, you will never, ever get there. And so that's been my concern from that perspective. With respect to the question that you have up on the screen and what I've heard about goalposts and these days where I'm coming from, where we're
21 out of 22. We're swinging for the ballpark, and the Rockies are looking really good. So we're not talking about goalposts where I'm from, or Galen, you know, home of the future World Series champions. It'll probably take us 4 or 5 games to put that one away. But with respect to 411, I actually probably would make a change or an addition. And the SEC has long had a rule, a principle, whatever you want to call it, because I agree there's not any real difference between either one. SEC views their compensation disclosure document, 450 pages, is a principle. That's what they keep telling us. I'm not sure I'd call that a principle, and I hope we aren't head down that direction with the principles. But I would the SEC does have this thing on their books that says, is kind of a catch-all that says, if there's material information that isn't caught up by some other rule, principle, or whatever, you still can't get out from underneath it just because there's not a rule on the books. And I don't think there's any way FASB or ISB can ever write something for everything. So when you start looking at 411.04, which originally was drafted coming out of the Continental Vending case, I would turn around and tell you that what we need to get into that is language. Not only have you made sure that these things are in accordance with GAAP and got all, you know, the required disclosures, but furthermore, let's add the language that the SEC has on their books in both the 33 and 34 Act that says, and as a catch-all, if there's other material information out there that's material to the financial statements and the reader of those financial statements, but it's not required by a specific rule, it needs to turn around and be disclosed. And that's about as principle-based a notion as you can get. So it also helps with this issue of goalpost, if you will, for both U.S. and international standards, because they both got these shortcomings, but that allows both the regulator as well as the auditors to say, hey, yeah, it may not be there in the book, but we need to get it in there. And so I'd certainly encourage you to make that modification to 411.
Thanks. So just as a side note, we do have something similar, at least along those lines. I believe it's an AU 431. I can't quote it to you, but we certainly will take a look at that. Thanks.
I would say after the Citigroup SIVs, not a whole lot of people are paying attention to it, if you do have it, because there's a lot of material information in the SIVs and a number of these institutions that was never disclosed and clearly material.
Galen Hansen.
Since we're talking about goalposts, I thought maybe I could mention something about a level playing field when we're talking about reconciliation. You know, over the course of my career, it used to be that we would go out and do the audit, and we're out there for some period of time, but usually it happened once a year. And as time has gone by, we're involved in these quarterly reviews. And for the larger engagements, people are virtually in the field, I mean, a good part of the year, and they're significantly involved with these issuers. And the point that I wanted to make is in the foreign side of this, where they the counterpart to a Form 10-K is a Form 20-F. And that that form, they're given, first of all, they're given 6 months, as I understand, to be able to file that. That would seem to have to be addressed, and it's probably more of an SEC issue. But also just the aspect of, from an auditing standpoint, being in the field, being involved with that client, and really knowing what's going on with them. I can tell you that in our firm, anyway, we do a lot of the auditing procedures on a quarterly basis, particularly in the area of equity and so forth. And it would seem to me that the foreign private issuers would have to have the same reporting standards as what our domestic issuers are. Right now, not all countries have interim reporting, so you don't have foreign private issuers that are necessarily issuing on a – I don't think they issue – very many of them issue on a quarterly basis at all. Some of them issue semi-annually – a semi-annual interim and then their year-end. So I think that might be something to consider. I'm not sure that it fit exactly into the question, but I think it does speak to auditing.
Kimberly Gabalitz.
Just reflecting on this topic that we've been discussing for a couple of hours now, I'm a little surprised by the surprise. I felt like when I entered into the auditing side of the world, albeit from the internal auditing side of the world in the 1999 timeframe, that we were on a path to convergence across the globe. We'd started the global accounting standards. I kind of entered into that, the rules versus the principles base, started having those debates, and really just saw people starting to work together. And with the advent of Enron and other activities, not only in the U.S. but around the world, I felt like we all kind of retrenched, tried to polish and make our own systems better. And I think we're just kind of emerging from that and getting back to the agenda and the convergence path I felt we were already on. So I'm a little struck by, I guess for some it may be new to them to be into it, but I really felt like we've been thinking about this for some time. And I think the progress and the data we're going to look at later from the research kind of shows we are making things better. We're on an evolutionary path. If there were bright lines, I think the smart people that are around this table and around the globe would have already defined them. Doesn't mean we shouldn't start keep looking for them to drive the variance out of it. But I think the reality is today, under a more rules-based, as we call it, world, there's a lot of judgment that still has to be applied. And I think the thing we deal with in this room each time is that the risk-based side of things, the judgment side of things, people are uncomfortable with that, and it is much easier to do a little equation and make it come out right. But I know from the operations side and in dealing with our auditors, we're constantly testing those judgments together under a rules-based approach, if you would say that's the U.S. approach. I don't see that changing or the aperture getting wider for myself in an international, and I would be interested in the accounting firm's view if they feel like there's a wider view on what would be acceptable outside of the U.S. boundaries from an IFRS standpoint. But I see it's just that constant engagement, and as long as you have a way, a governance structure, and an authoritative body to which, say, the SEC, that these eventually have to get filed into, those things are going to come together. And if the auditor and the company they're auditing don't agree, you know, that's how the opinion comes out. There are definite checks and balances. There isn't just a agree to disagree and then it just gets hidden. The transparency is key in all of this. And I think one of the transparency things and the working together things I'd encourage us to do is do like you've started here, list the differences and the changes, and let's just hammer them through. I'm not sure that bright lines exist on a lot of these things. That's why we keep looking at fair value. I mean, I applaud us and keep looking at it and keep looking at it, and there might be something that changes. But these are old issues that if, you know, they had a really easy answer, we might have already come to them. So don't give up the fight. Keep pushing forward. But we got to keep going on the journey. This is a global world. It's a global economy. Whether we go to anything of this nature or not, I believe the firms are already having to deal with this. So the firms that you're auditing already are in this world, whether anybody else adopts it or not. Thanks.
Well, let's now turn to the topic of auditor education. PCAOB standards require an audit to be performed by persons having adequate technical training and proficiency. Colleges and universities design accounting programs for students to pass the CPA exam, which is based on U.S. GAAP. Moreover, auditing firms need to take the lead in training their staff in auditing financial statements prepared in IFRS. This will bring us to the next series of questions for the SAG. And the first question is, what steps would colleges and universities need to take to train new graduates to audit financial statements of issuers prepared in accordance with IFRS? And there's two follow-on questions. First, what is the timeline to complete the task likely to be, and the second, what changes in the CPA exam, if any, might be required. Now I'll turn it over to the SAG for discussion. Joe Carcella.
There's a couple of implicit assumptions in your question. One implicit assumption is that all universities and colleges that offer accounting programs will even want
or agree to do this. A number of them may decide that they're better served training people for careers in managerial accounting, internal auditing, private company work, because the cost of gearing up to do this for colleges and universities is quite significant. And contrary to what a lot of people in this room may believe, most colleges and universities, really all of them, even the private ones, they're not profit-making enterprises. So they may say, hey, there's not a whole lot in this for us. We'll just serve a different market segment. And unless there's a surplus of people trained in the skill set, which every recruiter I talk to at firms like Vins and Bob's and Sam's, there seems to be a shortage, think very carefully about unintended consequences. So that's one issue. The other issue is unless the CPA exam is changed, you put faculty in a really very, very uncomfortable position, because students and their parents and taxpayers and a lot of people who are our constituents expect our graduates to pass the CPA exam. And if the CPA exam is still going to test FASB standards and SASs, and we're going to be training them on IFRS and PCAOB standards and maybe ISAs, international standards on auditing, there's a real disconnect between the licensing exam and what we're teaching them in school. And I don't know how that will play out. I really don't.
Dick Dietrich.
I want to reinforce some of the things that Joe just said. Right now students take a set number of hours. If we put something in, something else comes out. So the question is, we want to teach them IFRS, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for us to consider doing. What do we not teach them? And so we have to think about that. Or are we going to ask them to be in school for a longer period of time, to take additionally, essentially one more course or two more courses? Lynn Turner earlier today spoke to the issue of the need for curriculum materials. Now, faculty members can be very creative in developing their own materials. But if you want to have widespread adoption, it really does help to have content that other people can pick up. Third, to the extent that there are a large number of people who are not who would be the educators who are not now familiar with IFRS, we have a problem of training the faculty in the area as well. Fourth, we've talked to recruiters or students at Ohio State about the need for putting in a course in international financial reporting standards. 2 years ago, the answer generally was no, we don't need that. It's not very important for the kinds of clients that we have in the regions where our students generally work. And so we think about doing that again today. The question is, who are the clients that would actually need to have students who do that? If what we're talking about is a small sample of the total number of employees that are hired every year, and I believe the number roughly is 10 to 15,000 people a year going to work for the major public accounting firms. So you look at that and say, what percentage of those students would actually be in positions where IFRS education would benefit them? You get back to the next point that Joe raised, which is when they look at that against what they need to do for the other potential career opportunities they have, the need to prepare for the CPA examination, how will they make that evaluation themselves? And so there'll be a challenge that I think is especially significant if it's not included in the CPA exam, as Joe has identified. There'll be a different challenge if it is included in the CPA exam, because now we'll have a large number of students who are going to have to learn a body of knowledge that they will not use in their professional careers with great likelihood. So how will that work? Should that be done at the university, or should that be done in some other forum? For example, public accounting firms have very significant continuing professional education series. Is it something that would be better served by having them take on this responsibility? But if they do it after certification, then what role does the certification process play? Those are all of the issues that I think are raised here when one thinks about that. And we've had discussions previously about fair value and the extent to which we have to do fair value. I think someone else this morning gave a very nice litany of all the things that are sort of new topics. for how we do that. The other part of that that I think we should be careful about is when we think about certification requirements, we have to recognize that content will change over time. Faculties right now are willing to engage in content change. One of the things that holds us back is what's currently on the CPA examination. Students know that. And so when we say we have some interesting new content that we think will help you in your professional career, their response quite often is, if it's not on the CPA exam, I don't care. So we have to be careful about what's really driving the students here and the incentives that they face.
Galen Hansen.
I wanted to follow up with both Joe and Richard's comments because I think it dovetails exactly into the CPA exam and just kind of give you a little synopsis of how that works. There's basically a two-year lag. And as they were saying, I mean, it's not fair to students to test them on something that they haven't been taught in school. That just isn't going to work. But this two-year lag, we're currently going through, the Board of Examiners is going through an analysis, and they go through that exam, and there's psychometrics involved in this thing, QCing the examination. But there is about a two-year lag. So if we were to adopt it, the first time we would be able to start testing on IFRS would probably be sometime in 2009. So realistically, with the having to give students an opportunity to be educated in these standards, you're looking sometime well after that because it's going to take them some period of time to be educated. Not to, to throw water on the thing, but realistically, that's what you're looking at on the exam.
Leroy Dennis.
This is an extremely complex problem because as I listen to the educators here, and they do a fine job, but unfortunately, when they graduate students today, I'm looking at 5 years, 3 to 5 years before I give them any responsibility, and probably 10 to 12 before they sign off anything. And on my largest engagements of the world, it's probably 15 and maybe even more years down the road. So, you know, so that's all after my retirement, I hope. But the other thing I'd say is to train, you know, if we have a classroom situation today and we train somebody and they don't immediately go out and apply that in real world, they lose it in a fairly short period of time. So even if we had a program today where University of Ohio had an IFRS program and those students don't go into a world where they use IFRS day in and day out, then it will be a very short period of time before they lose that, and you'll be back to trying to figure out how do I train that person when I make them to be partner in IFRS. And so absent the U.S. going to a complete IFRS standard, I'm not sure I would support much in the way of a university program with this, and unfortunately that leaves it with the accounting firms. The other thing I'd say is when I look at the FASB, you know, what is the time frame going to be for the real convergence? If we're 5 years, 7 years down the road, by the time we get to where we can solve the problem from an education standpoint, the standards may be converged, and then you really can go in and have an education program because you've got one standard, they're going to be using it immediately, and it seems like we're maybe a little premature to at least look at the universities and say, you have to put something in place here.
David Becker.
What's interesting to me about this question is that it gets asked in the sense that it strikes me a little remarkable to be considering a standard that requires people to do things for which they are presently untrained. So that the notion, I mean, I'm not an auditing expert, but it sounds to me a little bit that what we if I said, you know, what we want to do is to give people the option of filing their disclosure documents in French, And we would say, all right, but we need a whole bunch of people who speak French in order to evaluate him. And then this question gives me the sense that there aren't a whole bunch of people who speak French and in the major auditing firms now. There's some. So the question is, you know, what's the cart and what's the horse? We've had some discussions about, well, we're not going to educate people to do things that they're not required to do. But it strikes me as potentially rather foolish to give issuers to do the choice of doing things that, that perhaps people aren't in a position to evaluate. What does strike me as critical is that the PCAOB have a view on whether the accounting profession is in a position to discharge its auditing responsibilities if the concept release turns into a rule proposal, and be prepared to communicate that view to the SEC, because I'm worried that there's a sort of whiff of utopianism around all of this, that in theory it would be great for everyone to be speaking Esperanto, but we just may not have that many Esperanto speakers out there.
I'm just going to put the next questions up on the overhead as well, but members of the SAC can continue to feel free to respond to the last question in addition to the next two questions as part of the larger discussion on auditor education. And just to introduce those next two questions on auditor education as well, the first is, what would be the major issues for auditing firms to consider to adequately train current partners and staff to audit financial statements of issuers prepared in accordance with IFRS? And then, what lessons can U.S. auditing firms learn from the adoption of IFRS in other jurisdictions? And feel free to continue to respond to the last question as well as part of the larger discussion on auditor education. Arnie Hanisch.
Yeah, I find this conversation to be fascinating. The idea that that somebody may not want to, that we be training people to do something that they may not use immediately, well, that happens every day in schools. People go to college, they take accounting classes, and some people take tax classes, but they become auditors, but they've lost everything maybe they've ever learned from that tax class that they learned in college because they've gone off to be an auditor. Or maybe vice versa, they took an auditing class and they chose to be a tax person. I mean, you know, to have an attitude that says that we're not going to teach something because it's going to be lost in 2 years, maybe we ought to be turning upside down the entire education system that we have in this country. But I think that it starts with trying to teach as an elective class. There's all kinds of elective courses out there that colleges and universities can offer to students to broaden their knowledge. And those students that will choose to take it, because maybe they're going to go with a Big Four, and maybe one day end up being seconded to an overseas location, or maybe they're going to come to work for a multinational company, because and if we have IFRS, they're going to have to at least understand some fundamentals. It just seems like if the colleges and universities don't begin to develop a curriculum around some of these new concepts, whether it's fair value accounting, whether it's IFRS, whatever the case may be, we're going to be graduating students that really are not are not current in what the needs are of the business world today. And so I think it starts with education, and as far as the fundamentals and the principles, as far as how do you teach them to audit, which is what I think the question is, they first have to understand the fundamentals, and then we can sort of incorporate that into our auditing classes. And then I think most of us know that we learned basic auditing, but then when we got out of school, we went to our first training classes, whether it was at PwC or Ernst & Young or whomever it was, and we had the fundamental foundation, and then they taught us, those schools or those firms taught us how their approach to auditing. So in the end, it's going to be, you come out of school with a fundamental framework and a background, you have understanding and knowledge, you go to work for an accounting firm, and that firm should have its educational programs honed to such a degree that they're able to teach their employees the principles of auditing and how they're going to go about the framework under which they've approached the profession. So there's a dual responsibility here between the colleges, universities, and the firms, but it starts at the university level, offering the classes so that these students at least come out with a framework and a foundational understanding of what some of the differences are. And I just think that the universities today, the curriculum is not keeping pace at all with the changing environment. And then there needs to be a lot of self-evaluation by the, the AAA or whatever organization it is that mandates and controls the curriculum, because the students coming out today do not have the basic foundation to deal with the complex world that we're in, whether it's fair value, derivatives. They're just not connecting the dots.
Sam Renzilla.
I'm not even sure where to start. This is an interesting conversation, only because it sounds like what we're talking about doing is taking a bunch of accountants and turning them into neurosurgeons. It's accounting. IFRS, GAAP, it's accounting. There's some basic principles that come right across it, and it's not all that difficult. And if, I appreciate that some may not be all that familiar with it, and as a result, there's a fear of the unknown, and I think that's very natural. But this is taking one accounting set of standards and going to another accounting set of standards. And if we look around the world, the bridge that we will travel here in the United States is much shorter than the bridge that was traveled by most of the countries who have adopted IFRS, who went from something that looked a lot like a set of tax accounts to something that, whatever your view of IFRS is, it's a lot closer to what we have in U.S. GAAP than what some statutory local GAAPs were. So our bridge, and depending upon the timetable with which we get there, I mean, that bridge could be very short by the time that we make that change, but to dismiss it because it looks like it's really difficult, I think is a little bit short-sighted. And now, if you're not for a single set of globally accepted accounting standards, then I agree with you. This conversation is irrelevant. But if you are for a single set of global accounting standards, I'm afraid to deliver the news that there's only one option left, and that's IFRS. And so as a result, I think that the real key is to develop a reasonable plan that takes into account the needs of preparers and auditors to get to the point where our marketplace can absorb the use of IFRS. It needs to take into account the educational system, but the educational system is, in this particular case, the tail wagging the dog here. And maybe I'll address that in respect of what we're already doing as firms with respect to training, which goes to the first question now up on the table. We've trained thousands of our people in the United States on IFRS. We did that because, as I mentioned earlier this morning, we had to credential them to already apply neurosurgery in the form of IFRS. Is it a small undertaking for us to get our people up to speed on IFRS? No. In fact, today we are devoting a fair amount of attention in my national office with what that plan looks like. And it's at times mind-numbing in terms of the volume of training that we'll have to do. But there is a basic set of standards, and what we're trying to do is bridge that set. So I think the real key is to focus on, again, it goes back to a basic question, though. Are you for a single set of globally accepted? If you are, then you can go one of two ways. You can say, well, I want to wait around for more convergence to occur, or I can fully embrace what is the only option that's left to go to that single set, embrace that, put a plan in place to where I'm comfortable that that's the right way to take this country to meet the rest of the world, then that makes a lot of sense to me.
Joe Carcella.
Well, I have a number of things to say, thanks to my colleagues in the room. Let me start off with an easy thing. If this is so important to the major firms, here's a suggestion for you. Give a consistent message to your partners in the field. I cannot tell you how often I will come back from these meetings or groups like this and share with my colleagues the feedback from this kind of an audience. And then the recruiters from your firms will come onto the campus and will give us a completely different message. Okay? So that would be the first suggestion that I would make. The second thing I would say is I think there needs to be some serious consideration of unintended consequences. Because to the extent that we go down this road of incorporating IFRS in university curriculums, think about costs and benefits for a second. The cost for students rise. It's not obvious to me that the benefits rise with that. The costs for faculty rise. It's not obvious to me that the benefits for faculty rise. Neither one of these groups in accounting programs right now do we have a surfeit of. Okay? There's not a surfeit of students. There's not a surfeit of faculty. Okay? Keep in mind that the incentive system for faculty guys, okay, again, I said we have 5 accounting professors in this room, some masquerading as other things right now. One from Texas, one at Michigan State, one at USC, one at Ohio State, and one at Tennessee. The reward structure for faculty guys, you know, this may be shocking to you. These are all Tier 1 research universities. So if you do not publish X number of papers in 3 journals, you get fired. Okay? So everything that is added onto this group just makes that career choice less attractive. Okay? So you need to think about that. Another alternative might be, well, why don't you just go recruit elsewhere where these research pressures don't exist? Well, Texas has about 48,000 students. Michigan State's in the mid-40s. Ohio State's around 50. Tennessee's around 27. I don't know how many Southern Cal has. But these are big programs. You don't want to wipe them off the slate, and they generally tend to be the most selective programs in states. So these are just brighter kids. And so I think to not go there would be a big mistake. Now, let me briefly address Ani's comment. Ani basically pointed out the deficiency as it relates to college curriculums and laid that blame at the feet of the AAA. The AAA has almost no control over curriculums at individual universities. If you want to lay blame, and I would join you probably, Ani, it's AACSB. AACSB is who accredits business schools, not AAA. And someone from Eli Lilly and other large corporations could actually have some effect, but it wouldn't be at the level of AAA. And then Sam talked about this being accounting, not neurosurgery. Sammy, if you haven't already looked at the CFA comment letter, you might want to look at the CFA comment letter. And here's what the CFA comment letter says. SEC staff comment letters to foreign private issuers, including some of the largest companies, indicate that IFRS financial statements were not in full compliance with IFRS as used by the IASB. The fact that some of the largest companies with presumably the most skilled and experienced accounting staff did not comply raises even greater concerns with those registrants who do not have such depth of knowledge and highly skilled staff. So maybe, Sam, for these large companies, maybe they did not make the change from tax rules to IFRS as seamless as you think. And if I ever need brain surgery, I hope these folks aren't holding the scalpel.
Bob Tirola.
Wow, I didn't mean to have to follow that one. I was hoping to just pile on with Arnie and Sam, but the only thing I want to point out is that in the world of a multinational company, we're already doing this. We're training our people in the different accounting regimes around the world, and we have to understand the difference between a local regime, whether it's IFRS or country-specific accounting, and U.S. GAAP, because we have to keep our books in local accounting standards and convert them to U.S. GAAP for purposes of consolidation. And the accounting department around the globe has to understand those differences. So the training is occurring within the multinational organizations who have to keep the books every day. The multinational organizations are also helping to train the auditing profession, who come in and look over our shoulders in converting local books to U.S. books. So we're helping there. But moreover, when you look outside the U.S., the training is occurring in this area, and they're helping us learn the difference as well. I think we're looking at this issue far too much from a U.S. Perspective and losing or missing the fact that multinationals have been embedded with this issue for decades. It's just gotten a little easier, actually, because there's now more or less one standard to compare to U.S. GAAP instead of numerous standards to compare to U.S. GAAP.
Vin Coleman.
Well, I guess I kind of feel the same way with this discussion. Being what I do every day and how we're now operating, I think there's a breakage between the timing of what is already happening and the knowledge of what is happening to the various constituencies. You know, when we talk about, I think it was very good advice to talk about making sure that we have got the right consistency in what we're asking for. But I would also assert that the world's changing here faster than I think people are understanding. So when you get to the needs, to Sam's point and Bob's point just now, there is a real need today for the expertise with respect to foreign entities that are in here and reporting back to foreign affiliates around the world. And the amount of investment coming in today is increasing very quickly, and therefore that need is only increasing. Right? You take real-life companies buying real-life companies, right? You've got Thomson buying Reuters. I mean, they are going to be on IFRS. We need that skill set today. When you talk about the differences, I mean, both the principle, the underlying principles, back to the, I'm not sure it's neurosurgery, but they're both Anglo-basis accounting. They're the basis, and then you've got some rules and some breakage. And I think that, to Sam's point, there's clearly going to be challenges that need to be met. I think mapping out those challenges and a way of dealing with those challenges, because it's going to happen either way. It's just a matter of time. So it's a matter of how are we going to walk and deal with these challenges and who is going to be relevant in dealing with them. Because you're right. No matter what, we've got to deal with this today. All right? We're already dealing with it. Right? And it is changing our philosophy of what we are doing because we have no choice. Right? The market is changing and we need to change with it. All three. And we're talking about IFRS, but I would move very quickly into the need around the valuation and finance skills for which we are seeing right now are becoming important. Not because we think they're more important. Business transactions are very different. Investors expect us to be able to understand them, and we need to react to it. And the standard setting process, whether it's convergence or not convergence, the 157s, the 159s are forcing a different skill set, whether we like it or not. So it's the environment that's changing, and we must change with that environment. And I would suggest that the CPA exam does need to change quicker, all right? And if that is the practicality of what's got to, you know, be the impetus for change, I would suggest that we need to really deal with that. Because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves further behind, all right, than I think that we really recognize. As it goes to this, we just all talked about accounting. As it talks about the auditing, we, at least in the larger firms, and there may be a breakage, which I think needs to be addressed in our profession, But in the larger firms, we already have a global methodology, as we talked about before, that takes on as a base the global auditing standards, and then we add to it what is required by the PCAO BIG. So we're already kind of there as it relates to the auditing, and if there are changes, we have to change our methodology to be able to deal with that today.
Lynn Turner.
I could get over there and kiss Sam for his comments about how accounting is so simple these days. I have been looking for someone to quote when I write into the SEC on their Committee on Complexity, Sam, and now I can quote you as saying it's very simple, and I look forward to your comment to him, letter to him as well, saying it's very, very simple, not rocket scientist stuff. I actually think this stuff isn't simple. I think in the business environment that we work in today, it is very complex and it is very challenging, as we're seeing from the subprime, where even the Federal Reserve Chairman has said on this supposedly very simple stuff, he can't figure out how to value it. And I don't think this is simple. I think it is tough and I think it is challenging. And I'd like to echo Carcello's comments to a T that he's made in this area. Furthermore, as Dick mentioned, there are definitely limited resources at each of these universities, and right now they are not provided the resources to grow. The profession needs about 10,000 graduates a year these days, and there's no way there's sufficient faculty on staff, and yet at the same time, even at the major institutions, they're not receiving the funding to hire up the additional staff. They have received no funding to turn around and start making a conversion like this. So while people say they all ought to do it, I ask, what are they to do it with? Because they're certainly not given the money, they're not given the resources, and I don't see the firms putting their money where their mouth is on that one, providing them with those resources as well. So I think this is not a simple move in any way, fashion, shape, or form. And I think people need to come to the table with money if they really want the universities to do that, to provide them the ability to do that. And then, quite frankly, if students are willing to go there, then the firms need to be willing to pay them for that as well, because right now you're underpaying versus the other professions by about half, which means you definitely aren't attracting the best and brightest, and you aren't going to get the best and brightest at the pay scales that you are saying. And finally, Sam, you mentioned the preparers and auditors. You actually forgot a very important piece of the equation in that sentence. You forgot the investors. And I can guarantee you in this country, investors, the number of investors that know international accounting are very slim. The third largest mutual fund in this country went through an extensive search trying to find one analyst who knew international accounting, and it took them an extremely long time to try to find that resource. So this is not a simple thing to do, but I'll be most interested in seeing your comment to the SEC on it.
We still have a number of questions in this area to cover. We really want to hear your thoughts. This is an important area. I'd ask Greg and Brian if they can try to wrap this up in 20 minutes, which means we'll eat up 10 minutes of your break time. But if you can, try to keep your comments concise, and we'll try to maybe pick up the speed just a little bit so we can get through all the questions. Thanks.
Jeff Steinhoff.
It just strikes me that change is something that happens all the time. Accounting standards, accounting treatments, business is changing all the time. So education is a lifetime job. You never stop learning, and this is probably no different and no more complex than some of those issues. The 150 hours that was mentioned earlier, let's be honest with you, it's no one prescribes what the 150 hours are in. You can be a basket weaving major, have your hours in that, and then shift into accounting at the end and get 150 hours without taking extra accounting hours. But I think the bigger issue here is that this is not so much as an auditing issue as a standards issue. And I think you need to have a master strategic plan that lays out where we want to go, And what are the various component parts of that? One part would be the auditors. One part would be the preparers. One part would be the role of the colleges and universities. And assure that that strategy is integrated or tied together. Right now you've got diverse parts, and you're trying to debate today what the auditor can do. Well, an audit's an audit. And if you change the standards or the rules, the auditor must adapt and must learn what those new standards are. If you've got a new financial instrument, the auditor has to learn what the new financial instrument is. If the corporation they're auditing reconfigures itself, they have to learn what that new reconfiguration is. But the real issue is it's not an auditing as much as it is deciding what the financial reporting requirements will be, what the standards will be. And having a master strategic plan for addressing that with a recognition how the various component parts can work together, and then some type of metrics that gives us some sense when we're prepared to move ahead so that the various parts know what the other parts are supposed to be doing, and we move ahead in an intelligent way, and people aren't left at the station when we actually move ahead. I think that's more broadly probably what the issues are here today. And, you know, the sooner it is resolved, I guess, what the accounting rules will in fact be and whether or not this reporting will be allowed as that third option in really making that decision, I think it would be of great help if the SEC, working with the others, laid out, well, what are some of the other things that must be online for this to successfully roll out? I will agree with Lynn that these are complex issues, but I'll also agree with Sam. I mean, this isn't rocket science, and that there have been so many changes in what is required in an audit over the past 10, 15, 20 years, not to mention the tremendous pressures that I think are really facing the audit community going forward as technology continues to evolve. And the auditor must deal in a whole realm which is totally different than the realm they're in today, and a realm where, frankly, they may never be able to deal with really the purview of an engineer. How do these systems really work? How is this information really flowing? Do you really understand that as an auditor? And you really understand what these records are showing in a totally wired world, so to speak. So, again, a good plan that looks at all the issues, and I see the PCAOB as being one part of that, but I don't think these are necessarily issues today that the PCAOB can resolve.
Tom Linsmeyer.
I want to, first of all, generally agree with the approach that Jeff just talked about. I'm speaking for myself. This isn't official FASB views, okay? This is a masquerading academic, right, that is in the job daily of trying to make this convergence thing work. It's not easy. When you got two boards, two locations, two different sets of politics, two different sets of views, different regulators, to first of all converge standards, and then second of all, after they're converged, assuming we get there, maintaining that convergence as application implementation guidance is required as we move forward. It is a messy process, and it's not one, if we really do want one global reporting language, the way to get it done. We cannot go, we can't work together with the ISB permanently and remain converged. I don't think that's possible. So what do we need to be doing? We have to decide whether or not we're going to partake in this move to one global standard setter. And lots of things have happened in the last few months. Korea decided to go from U.S. GAAP to IFRS. Canada decided to go to IFRS. China, Japan. This isn't just a European phenomenon. We're getting to the point where we're going to be isolated if we decide to stay U.S. GAAP. in terms of being the only ones or very few ones that are not trying to move to this IFRS. And there is a challenge getting to one IFRS. There's too many IFRSs here. All right? But what we have to do is decide if we're going to decide that we're going to partake in having, be part of the language around the world that everyone else is communicating in. And I don't think we have a choice anymore, personally, how we're going to do it. And the one thing I think that would be bad to do it would be to follow the route the SEC is suggesting with the concept release. I think having two systems in place at the same time just increases the cost and messes up the conversation, because you end up having to decide whether you're going to, everybody's going to know both IFRS and US GAAP for how long, when you transition in, when you transition out, and that's just accounting standards. Then we've got auditing standards, we've got a whole lots of other items. So my belief is if we're going to decide that we're going to be part of this process, we've got to pick date certain when we're going to move to it. And then decide the paths forward that all of us have to take. Accounting standard setters, auditing standard setters, educators, etc. How long do we need that path to take? How do we minimize the cost and maximize the benefits to get there? I think that's what we should be talking about. And then we will know if it's date certain when we need to be ready to be fully up under IFRS system, perhaps some converged auditing standards. You will not have as much conflict with the academics having to say, should I be teaching both? I mean, if you teach both and you only have 150 hours now, and even though there is some belief that there's a lot of loose credits out there in the system, I'll assure you, as a masquerading academic, there's not. There's tons of things we're teaching and putting into curriculums that are of value long-term and short-term in those areas, that adding on a whole other system to this at this point would be extremely challenging and not incentive compatible. How do you end up doing that? And so I think picking a date, certain date, and figuring out the length and figuring out what we have to do, I think what we have to do as FASB is decide what standards need improving and limit our agenda to the improvement standards and get those done and minimize the differences so that when we change, there's not as much difference. But we may also want to decide in that time period to start adopting some IFRS standards that are very similar just to ours and putting them through our process. That's just one person's view. But we've got to walk forward and minimize that change. And, yes, change is difficult. But I agree wholeheartedly, we need a plan. All of us need to be in the plan. We've got to figure it out, how many years, and what is the path forward with targets to hold each other accountable. I agree with that.
Dick Dietrich.
I think you all underestimate the difficulty of what you do every day. It turns out I have a degree in physics, Leroy. This is a whole lot harder than rocket science. We should recognize that, okay? That's not a bad thing. Also, when you think about, can students come in right out of school and do the job of a partner? You should hope not. Otherwise, partners would get paid $50,000 a year and you'd all be replaceable. Right? This is way more complicated than that. So first, let's recognize that what you do is phenomenally difficult work. And let's really celebrate that as opposed to denigrate it. All right? So I'm very impressed with the people in the room. Second thing, as far as universities are concerned, can we do this? The answer is sure. We can do it. All right? If you want us to teach IFRS, we can teach IFRS. There will be the trade-off issue that Tom mentioned. What are we not going to teach instead? But why would we do this? Well, it's not a question of why we would, as a faculty, would do it. It's a question of why the students are going to learn it. One of the questions that you don't see on a regular basis, although some of you or your other folks in your organization do, is that students are making decisions every day whether they want to choose accounting as a major or something else as a major. And so right now, many students choose finance as a major because they see it as a fast way to get out in 4 years where they can do jobs that quite often are very similar. And frankly, I will tell you that quite often your firms will hire those people right now and pay them the same amount as somebody who gets a 5-year degree. Now, that's just the reality. That's what our students see. So
in order to make this work, it's a question of incentives, right? What are you prepared to do as employers to incent students that they want to take this course? If the students say they want to take it, I assure you that it'll be offered. The other thing about that is to think about the customization aspect of it. Right now, by my best estimates, we have about 100,000 students a year who get a degree in accounting at some university. Of that, the profession hires now 10 to 15,000. Of them, I don't know, but I'm guessing that maybe on the order of 1,000 students would actually be engaged in a practice where knowledge of IFRS would be relevant. So that means out of all of the public or all of the universities in the United States that are teaching accounting, you're talking about 1 out of 100 students potentially, or 2 out of 100 students who would actually be benefited, and society would benefit from having them receive this knowledge. So one of the questions is that something that's best done on our campus or best done by you all later? That is, it's not the case that we're, at least I don't believe that universities are the repository of all education. We're not. Education can occur with your firms as well. What we should find out is who's best suited to do it and where it should be done, and then we can work through those. And those are the issues we have in front of us. So it's not that these things are insurmountable issues. They simply require more dialogue, and we'll get it done.
We're just going to introduce the next question, and participants can feel free to continue to respond to Auditor Education, but we just want to keep get the next set of questions introduced. And the next question deals with implications to a firm's system of quality control. And the question is, what are the possible implications related to a firm's system of quality control, including its training needs, if U.S. issuers choose to prepare financial statements in accordance with IFRS? And Rebecca McAnally.
I had this up before that question, so if you'll permit me. Dick, I also have a degree in physics, and I agree with you. This is a lot harder than celestial mechanics. It's vastly harder, no doubt about it. Joe, thank you for reading the paragraphs from our letter. If you liked those paragraphs, you're going to love the rest of the letter, and I'll be glad to get you a copy. Jeff's comments and Tom's comments have made my comments much simpler. This morning, I remarked that we've got problems of staggering proportions, and we have no plan or infrastructure in place to address those problems. And I made a brief call to the board. I pleaded with the board to start thinking about what they could do to exercise some leadership to help all of us develop a plan that will deliver us to the end goal. Well, you've just heard this twice, just before me. Jeffrey has called for this, and so has Tom. I have also heard a call for the PCAOB to take a position. The PCAOB has been given, under the law, certain responsibilities. And in order to fulfill those responsibilities, they have to be able to do certain things. And so it's only reasonable that the PCAOB itself have a view about what needs to be done and what resources are going to be required for them to be able to fulfill their responsibilities. So I would simply encourage the board to move forward on this and help us all out.
Jeff Steinhoff.
I want to respond to your question up there on the board. It really strikes me that, you know, certainly you'd have to train up your staff to make sure you had a fully competent, trained, and knowledgeable staff. But I wouldn't think the quality control process in a firm would change. They might look at certain things here. They would assure their training, as they would for any new area to them, was up to snuff. But I wouldn't see that their quality control system would be any different, assuming they had a good one going in.
Sam Renzilla.
I'm actually afraid to speak again because I really don't want Lynn Turner to kiss me. But argue with him is fine, but the kissing part, I'm sorry.
I think to answer this question, and I guess, you know, maybe a bit in defense of earlier comments, my comment was not that what we did was simple, but the conversation prior to my comments was appeared to me that we were trying to take people who were accountants and turn them into neurosurgeons, as opposed to taking people who are accountants that have a very solid understanding of U.S. GAAP based on their educational experiences both in universities and with the firms and working with our clients who are also a part of that educational system and converting them over to be able to understand and apply IFRS. I honestly believe that the educational system of taking some of our people who are very good in U.S. GAAP and making them very good in IFRS is not really a whole lot about what's in the two standards. It's actually much more around change management and the ability to apply standards that have more basic principles than some of our standards, which are more rules-based, although I don't think that there's that distinction between U.S. GAAP and IFRS is so clear. But there are some places where more judgment. And that's, from our perspective, we're looking more at the training around how to train our people to understand transactions better and to get to the substance of those transactions and to be able to apply judgment where that judgment is going to be needed under IFRS, where U.S. GAAP may get you down and may get you down to an answer based on a set of rules that you apply. With respect to Jeff's question on the quality controls, I think the accounting firms have a basic business decision to make here in terms of their audit practice, in that do you create, in a world where we have U.S. GAAP and IFRS as two standards, and whether that be two standards for public companies or if the SEC were to adopt IFRS at some point, but we don't know where the private companies will end up in terms of what accounting standards that this country will apply, but assume that there's two, either way you cut it. But I think the accounting firms have got to make a decision. Do they have a staff that, in essence, they bifurcate? So you go sit on the U.S. GAAP side, you go sit on the IFRS side, and there's some pros and there's some cons, I think, to that approach. The other is a bilingual. We make everybody speak both sets of principles, both sets of languages, such that they can cross over whenever we need to be. There's pros and there's cons to that argument as well. I don't know what the answer to that is. A lot of it might be how long is that bridge between the two, to Tom's point of when you cross over, how much convergence was yet to occur, or how much is the difference? But I think that's where, as my firm looks at this, from a quality control perspective, it's around that question, which is very fundamental to how we operate our business. Inside of each, if we had two silos, then the quality controls would be pretty much the same up through. You'd have all the same quality controls that you'd have to have in place.
And we're just going to move ahead to question number 11, which deals with the market implications to auditing firms. And the question for the SAG to discuss is, are there potential market implications if some audit firms would not, or at least would not initially, provide audit services to U.S. issuers who prepare their financial statements in accordance with IFRS? And I'll open it up to the SAG for discussion. Kayla Gillum.
I was actually hoping to ask a more fundamental question of the accounting firms in the room. Are any of you contemplating taking this position, that i.e. that you would not provide this type of service to U.S. issuers?
I'd be amazed if any of the large firms were, but we're certainly not planning to take that position. I would suspect that if there were only a very limited opportunity for a firm, maybe that would be a choice they might want to make. But I've actually never addressed this question, but we'd obviously be serving those clients.
Galen Hansen.
Our firm is a local practice. We have about 400 people. We're doing IFRS work right now. And we're probably unusual, however. For small firms, I don't know what the answer to that question is, and it certainly goes to competition, and I think that's something, you know, all of us are concerned with. The other point that I would make, and we see this with AS 5404, there's certainly a trickle-down effect, however. And the trickle-down effect would be to the private side of the practice, working with privately held companies, nonprofits, governmental entities. What's the impact on them? And I suspect that could be a substantial impact, especially if it were the case that eventually FASB is somehow totally absorbed into IASB. And then where are the private sector standard setters? And how does that affect, you know, a major part of the economy? It doesn't maybe impact PCOB as it relates to them, but there is a huge impact, and there's a huge concern out there as far as who would set their standards going forward, whether it be auditing, ethics, accounting.
That concludes our discussion. Thanks for your valuable input, and we'll turn it back over to Tom Ray now.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and break and start again promptly at 5 minutes after 3:00.